We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Australian True Crime. Hello, patrons, and there has never been a better time to become a patron. $2 or $5, that's in US currency, don't forget that. We have some events coming up, though. They're going to be really cool. They're going to have really cool guests at them, and patrons get to buy tickets earlier, I believe. So, that's a good idea, isn't it? Thank you specifically to Lisa Svensson, Diane Dunn, Emily Saker, Kat Barrow. Is that how you say that? It looks really good. Good spelling. Bree Quich. Quich. So many consonants. Love it. Imka. D. Danielle. Eliza Mayle. Kai and Blair. Shannon Ince. Rebecca Page. Summer Benson. Isil Ozmania. Ozdemir, that's it. Isil Ozdemir, beautiful. And Kim Reid. That's a good one, Kim. Thank you, easy one. Thank you so much for being patrons. Thank you to everyone for your support. It's time for the show. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
Ten's veteran reporter Harry Potter has been covering the state's biggest crimes for more than 30 years. In his last week in the Ten newsroom, he's been looking back at some of the cases that have stayed with him. Now, Harry, the focus is often on the criminals and their victims, of course, but what about those left behind?
Well, one victim I've never forgotten is also one of the most tragic. Her name's 16-year-old Gordana Katevsky. She was abducted off the street back in 1994 by two men. Now, when I called on the family the next morning, her grandfather was sitting on the front doorstep sobbing his heart out. I felt then it was almost as if he knew she was never coming back. Just 16, Gordana had been shopping with schoolmates before she was grabbed off the street near her aunt's place. Two men in a white Toyota Hilux with a fiberglass rear tray canopy stopped in front of her. Gordana screamed when she was dragged into the ute as it sped off. While a coronial inquest declared the teenager dead in 2003, her body has never been found.
Gordana was an extremely popular young lady. She was an upstanding member of society, and her loss has really affected not only her family but her close friends and the general community.
No family should have to endure what the Katevskys have been through these past 16 years. While the police are still doing all they can, all it needs is someone with vital information and also a conscience to make a quick confidential phone call to detectives. That would trigger a breakthrough.
Harry Potter, 10 News.
Two things. One, yes, that reporter's name really was Harry Potter. And two, he was one of the greatest crime reporters Australia has ever produced. He passed away in 2014, and we remember him in this episode of Australian True Crime in the way he chose to remember Gordana Katevsky in one of his last on-air appearances in 2010. Sadly, 9 years later, Gordana is still missing. Her kidnappers remain unknown, and her family continues its tireless work to keep the case alive.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Several listeners have contacted us over the last year or so asking us to cover this case, which means that someone is doing an excellent job at keeping it in the public's consciousness. That person is Gordana's auntie, Julie, whom we spoke to on the phone. Not long before the call, Julie notified us that Gordana's mother, Peggy, would like to speak to us as well. So you'll be hearing from Peggy a little later on. But first, we asked Julie about being the family spokesperson.
Somebody has to do it. I'm a close family member. Peggy is my sister-in-law, and I kind of, try to take the burden away from them sometimes. I'm happy to kind of be the spokesperson and the in-between person, and it's just something that I feel like I have to do. It's not an easy thing, as you can imagine, but somebody has to be doing something.
And that's what we find. Often a family member will take up that the mantle of being the spokesperson, and it's often like an auntie or a sibling who takes on that role. How do you cope with that, Julie?
I think I cope with it reasonably well. I can't say that, I guess, for my husband. My husband thinks I'm a bit crazy sometimes because he sees me up late at night and I'll be on the computer or investigating or trying to find ways of keeping or done a story out there in the news. I don't know. It just comes naturally to me. I was doing it for many, many years after her disappearance, and then I just felt like I had to stop because it was all-consuming. But last year, something ignited a spark. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the right time. I don't know. And since then, we've had a number of interviews, TV stories, a couple of campaigns which have brought the story back to light. So, yeah, somebody's got to do it. I'm glad that it's me, because I know how much the family misses her, how much they love her, and I miss her terribly myself. And if I could bring some sort of closure, that would be awesome.
1994 sounds like a long time ago, and yet when I think back to what I was doing in 1994, it doesn't seem like that long ago. So what can you tell us about the disappearance of your niece, Gordana?
Just going from my own experience that night, I'm just conscious that Peg's here with me as well, and it's quite painful for her to listen as well. But we remember receiving a phone call from my sister-in-law that Gordana was missing. This is my other sister-in-law where it happened in front of her home, and my husband quickly left the house to go and start searching. They were out all night. Peg's husband, Branko, at the time, a couple of other family members out all night searching, and I woke up in the morning thinking, oh, this is all really a bad dream, and my husband hadn't come home at the time, and I remember putting the radio on and thinking, please don't let there be anything, please don't be anything, and sure enough, it was on the radio, and I thought, oh, my God, this is real.
It was a news story, was it, that a 16-year-old high school student had disappeared?
Yeah, and that is just, that night will never go away. As I said, I just woke up hoping it was a dream, but it wasn't. It wasn't.
Now, I'm mindful that you don't want to talk too much about the details in front of Peggy, who is sitting beside you, but can I ask if you knew immediately that Gordana had been snatched, is the word that is used now in reports, and pulled into a white Toyota Hilux out the front of her auntie's home at about 8:45 p.m. Was that known immediately to you?
No, not those circumstances.
Okay.
Everything came to light in the following few days when the story started to unfold, and just trying to understand the whole picture of from the time she left Charlestown Square to head down to her auntie Sonia's house. As I said initially, that's all we knew. She was missing. We didn't know the circumstances. Sonia had found Gordana's wallet and a torn plastic bag down the bottom of the driveway. So we didn't really know. And it was only later on, there was quite a few witnesses. There were lots of boys. There was a number of boys on skateboards. There was an older lady that saw her walking down the street, that saw the white car. But the picture didn't become clear immediately. It was the following days where they started to pull things together as witnesses were coming forward.
Was there any inkling that anyone might have been, you know, stalking her or watching her, or had she had any, you know, bad interactions with people? I think I read that in her part-time job there was someone who was maybe harassing her a bit.
Yep. So you would be referring to the person that was commonly known as the spook. There had been instances where a fellow was infatuated with her. He would arrive at her place of employment. She ended up changing her place of employment and he would arrive there. Her best friend Belinda had seen him, and I believe that Gordana knew this boy's name, or that's what Belinda has told me, but she referred to him as a spook. So nobody really knows who this person was, and there's been no evidence to prove whether he was involved in this at all. But it may have just been a case of infatuation. It may have been more, but none of that's ever been proven by anyone.
Maybe the reinvestigation might flush out a bit of information about that, just at least either, you know, rule it out or...
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, the reinvestigation will take months. As I said, the number that was quoted to me was 62 boxes of evidence that they have to go through.
And even it was 2009 when a fingerprint was discovered on the plastic bag.
Yes, that's right.
That contained
a fingerprint which hasn't been matched.
No, still hasn't been matched to anyone. So even, I mean, is more information still coming to light all these years later? Do you feel like the case is still being investigated?
Well, we found out, and I can make this public now, the case is being fully reinvestigated. We have a number of detectives at the Newcastle Lake Macquarie District Command who contacted me the other day to advise that the case is being reinvestigated, and they have many, many, many boxes of evidence to go through, but they're looking at it with fresh eyes. We did have a couple of campaigns running last year. We had a bumper sticker campaign, and we had thousands of stickers printed, and people were asking for them from businesses, just the general public. And then we had a billboard campaign that happened in December, which I think probably sparked another keen interest in finding out what had happened.
There's a lot of interest as well in cold cases, and we've seen a lot of... well, not a lot, but some cases that are quite old be solved. So it really sounds so encouraging that, you know, there's going to be some fresh eyes on this case, because sometimes that's all it takes, isn't it? Fresh eyes and people to come forward after a number of years who mightn't have felt comfortable coming forward back in 1994.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, it'll be 25 years in November, but it's a quarter of a century. Things have changed. People have grown up. People are aging. You know, maybe someone wants to unburden themselves, get it off their chest. We want justice for Gordana, and that is our hope, that we get justice for her. We would love to find her, but it's an unknown. We don't know what we're dealing with.
Were there any other cases similar to this in Newcastle at the time that could, you know, point to people who were sort of acting this way around town at the time? Was this an isolated case?
Well, in 1994, I'm not aware of any other similar sort of cases in 94, but in the late 70s, there were a number of young girls taken, four of them, I believe, in this period of four months.
There was an investigation called Strike Force Fenwick. The police were looking at the disappearance of, it sounded like about 20 women who had gone missing in abduction type scenarios or just mysteriously disappeared.
Yep.
And was Gordana's case part of that?
It was. It was. I'm not entirely sure who the 20 were, but I do know that it was Leanne Goodall, Amanda Robinson,
Robin Hickey.
Mm-hmm. There was one more. I can't remember. They were the main folk. Oh, Amanda Zollis. They were the main four that we were aware of. That strike force was started up by Clive Small. I can't remember his title now. He was... He's retired now.
He's very, very famous. Yeah, he's a very famous detective, isn't he, in the New South Wales Police Force. He's the man credited with capturing Ivan Milat.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Well, he was behind the strike force. He introduced the strike force to get something happening, because I think he, from what I've read too, he was quite disillusioned that when he was going back over these cases back in the 70s, that there didn't appear to be any real efforts in trying to find the girls. I believe a couple of them were just believed to have been reported or recorded as runaways. Mm. They weren't being treated as abductions or a missing person. So he did the right thing and put this strike force together to try and investigate this as a group lot. But and Ivan Milat, unfortunately, was one of those people that was a person of interest in those cases, but not in Gordana's. He was not in the area at the time. So, yeah, I don't know whether I can provide any more information on that one for you.
No, you don't have to. I can't imagine a situation in which that could be raised as a possibility in your family's case. It just must be the most horrifying thought.
The idea of having his name in a sentence with someone that you love is just incomprehensible. In 2003, there was an inquest.
Mm. Well, were there any persons of interest named in the inquest?
There were a couple. From memory, I can't remember the fellow's name. There was one that they were trying to track down. He was in the Northern Territory. They didn't get him in for the inquest, and we've never heard anything since that. There was also... there were lots of things. The crime scene wasn't secured quickly by the police. It had been compromised. Not just, you know, people, family coming to try and help. There were papers lost, I believe, during the investigation, lost by police. There was a statement that was lost. I mean, the coroner was pretty scathing, I have to say.
Corey Lovett was the fellow named as a person of interest in the 1994 disappearance of 16-year-old Gordana Kotevsky in Newcastle. The inquest heard that in December 1994, so about a month after Gordana's kidnapping, Taree detectives took a statement from Mr. Lovett, who bore a striking resemblance to a facial sketch being circulated by police at the time. But the inquest was also told that Newcastle detectives in charge of the case chose not to travel to Taree to interview Mr. Lovett themselves. It's a two-hour drive. Instead, Taree police interviewed him and faxed their report to detectives in Newcastle. Subsequently, both the fax and the hard copy of Lovett's statement were lost. Lovett left Taree shortly after the interview. The inquest also heard that initial police investigations failed to pick up discrepancies in Corey Lovett's alibi. One Craig Pont claimed Mr. Lovett was with him at his property at Kippax, west of Taree, when Gordana disappeared. Yet Mr. Lovett allegedly told Taree police he was in Newcastle at the time. Newcastle detectives took a statement from two people who claimed Mr. Lovett was with them in Newcastle, but not involved in Gordana's abduction. The inquest also heard from witnesses who claimed that Mr. Lovett had boasted about knowing where Gordana's body was buried and had made other remarks about her abduction and death. Although they believed Corey Lovett was residing somewhere in the Northern Territory at the time of the inquest, police were unable to locate him and he never gave evidence. New South Wales State Coroner John Abernethy, who presided over the 2003 inquest, found Gordana had been murdered by a person or persons unknown. But he also presided over the Strike Force Fenwick re-examination of the case in 2009. And he's recently been quoted as saying that, while he can't be sure, he does believe the case may be linked to other abductions of women in the area over a period of up to 30 years, and that there may have been the same person or group of people responsible.
After the break, we talked to Gordana's mother, Peggy. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Gordana's mother Peggy talks about life after losing Gordana, and we hear about the rumour that some believe derailed the investigation in its first critical days.
You know, 25 years down the track, there's these boxes and boxes of evidence. You know, there could be just that one thing that was missed.
Well, that's what they say. The great detectives say the answer is in the file.
Mm. Yep.
Julie, the answer is in the file.
Yep.
What can you tell us about the family since in the years since Gordana has gone missing? What are the effects that this has had on the family?
Okay, well, unfortunately, Gordana's parents separated. There was a lot of stress on the relationship. The kids have grown up. I mean, Damien's brother was 11 at the time when she was taken, and it was just a devastating time for him. He couldn't talk about it for many, many years. He's now a married man himself and, you know, hoping to have a family one day himself. And he, you know, he loves and misses his sister dearly, but just couldn't talk about it. He would spend weekends with my boys, with his cousins. You know, they would keep him distracted, keep him busy while we were out searching. So we were trying to protect him from the horrible thing that had happened. His older sister, Carolyn. Carolyn was actually living in Sydney at the time. She was a young mum, had a little boy at the time, and she actually happened to be in Newcastle that evening, and they were supposed to see each other. Carolyn had rung over at her aunt's house looking for Gordana. Gordana hadn't arrived, and the nightmare started. So as a young mum, Carol had to take this on as well. And in the end, you know, she came back home to live in Newcastle to be closer to her family. Mm. Carolyn has spoken up a number of times over the years how it has affected her. And, how do you deal with losing a sibling? It's just incomprehensible.
How far did your searches take you when you were out looking for Gordana? Did you follow your own leads, or where did you go?
I know myself and my husband, I can't really say for others, but I know the Macedonian community were all involved. Like, we had hundreds of people just getting in their cars and just driving anywhere. We would meet up with four-wheel drive clubs on weekends and just go out. We were taken into places I never even knew existed. But they were still primarily Newcastle area, sort of outer suburbs, bushland, sand dunes at Stockton, which unfortunately there's been some incidents there over the years. So that was our own investigations, you know, physically searching. But I know that Gordana's dad often, you know, would just get in the car and drive up north. I know, I think he went from as far as Port Macquarie. Could have been a lot further, I don't know. But there was always searching. It's just something that you do. You don't even think about it. You just do it. Somebody has to do it. And, you know, we were lucky. We had lots of family and friends who were willing to get involved and search, but you can only do so much. You know, we live in a big country, huge.
So Peggy has agreed to speak to us as well.
She has indeed. You know, there are periods where something will happen, like the fingerprint story in 2009. Mm. It just kind of brings it all back up again. And I know with the billboard and everything that was happening last year, there were requests for interviews. So there have been a few requests. This is the first podcast that the family's done. Mm-hmm. Lots of people have said, oh, you know, you should do a podcast. Well, you know, it's not that easy to just do a podcast.
So. Oh, I know exactly what you mean. People say, oh, look at all those podcasts that are solving crimes.
Yeah.
But no, it's not easy for a family who doesn't work in this industry or whatever to just suddenly make a big podcast. Those podcasts have got big newspapers behind them and
they do.
And all of
they
that
do.
Stuff.
And I guess you have to be really careful what you say too. Mm. I mean, I know in the Lynn Dawson case, there was talk about, you know, all this information's come through the podcast, but what does that actually mean for the case? Does it compromise the case in any way? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. They've just taken down all the episodes of the podcast. You can't listen anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, because they want to make sure that it doesn't compromise the case.
Right.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's a lot to think about. And you guys are, I guess, always in that position, aren't you, where you want to get information out as much as possible, but
yeah,
you have to be careful.
You do. You've always got those people that have, you know, their own ideas of what happened, you know, conspiracy type stuff. And, you know, that's really very hurtful.
Yeah.
You know, Gordana was a good kid. She was a beautiful young lady with a gorgeous heart. And, you know, my fondest memories of her was she was my little flower girl and she was always on my lap. The most loving child, and very family focused. She adored her family. She would never, you know, do anything to hurt or upset anyone. Like, she was so excited to be going to a concert that week, and that was her first real taste of freedom, really, because, you know, fairly strict background. She was planning on going to a concert. That's why she was out shopping that evening. That, you know, the things that were in that shopping bag were the things that she bought to wear to the concert. And she was just a young girl that didn't have a chance. She was in a dancing group, Macedonian traditional folk dancing. She loved doing her dancing. I think she enjoyed her soccer as well. Her brother used to play soccer. You know, the Macedonian community was reasonably tight-knit. Everybody knew everybody, but she was well-liked at school, many, many friends at school. She's just a good kid.
I guess it never occurs to me, but what I feel like I'm hearing you saying is that there may have been rumours about her being somehow being a kind of girl who may have known these men or something like that. Like, there may have been some kind of victim blaming or rumours about...
Oh, no, the rumour mill was... part of it was, it was an arranged marriage.
Oh,
you know, people just assume it's not an Australian background, it's an arranged marriage. I mean, if you know Peggy, Peggy's more Australian than, the Prime Minister, I guess.
Yeah.
That's just simply not true. And it was quite offensive to hear things like that. It's like, wake up to yourself.
That's what I mean. It never occurs to me, but yeah, of course, there'd be some weird rumours about the family or the victim. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
Yeah. And I've got to give Peg credit. She's sitting here right next to me. She is one of the strongest women I know. I don't know how she does it. She gets up every day. She goes to work. She gets on with her life. She has to. She does it for her family. She does it for her children. She does it for her grandchildren. And she's now a great-grandmother. And, you know, she lives for them.
Yeah.
So I have to give her credit. She's just an amazing woman and very resilient. Tough cookie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is the question we all wonder. Would you mind if we spoke to Peggy?
Not at all. She's right here.
Thank you so much, Julie.
No worry, thanks.
Hello.
Hi, Peggy. How are you? It's Michelle and Emily here.
Hi, how you going?
We're fine, but we now, you know, we have the question that everyone has, which is, how do you do it, Peggy?
Yeah, one step in front of the other. Some mornings are harder and other days are easy, I suppose.
Do you have confidence that that you feel like you might be getting somewhere new with this new investigation, new investigators looking at it?
Personally, not really, no. Been there, done that before, to be honest. Yeah, I don't have any expectations whatsoever. I've learnt that the hard way in the beginning.
Yeah. Do you feel let down over the years by how Gordana's case has been investigated?
I think initially they didn't have enough experience to deal with something like that, and that was the most crucial time that anyone can act on anything like that. But later on, they put people together, and that we had a great. Crew of detectives working and that, but it was too little too late.
Do you feel as though you know what happened? Do you, how much?
Not really. I couldn't say, you know. Part of me says she's out there somewhere, part of me says, you know, it depends on the day and what your emotions are dictating, really. Sometimes I think the worst has happened, other times I don't. It's just the not knowing what has happened, that's probably the worst thing.
Oh, Peggy, I just can't imagine that, not knowing. How do you cope? How do you cope when you're alone at night time?
Well, I suppose over the years you develop coping mechanisms that you never had before, and we were fortunate actually in the beginning when we deal with the uni and all the solicitors working towards all the cases for the girls. We had a psychologist on deck that she helped me a great deal. But I've always been a realist, so I don't, you know, you can hope and wish, but you got to deal with reality as well. And that's probably what hurts the most.
Peggy, have you had much to do with other mothers, parents who are in your same situation? Like, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, when Gurdana went missing, I knew one of the girls, Amanda Zolas. She, I used to, because I worked as a residential support worker at the time for disability, and I used to look after Amanda's sister. And I knew the mum, Cecily Zolas. So when Gurdana went missing, she came to see me, and then we sort of tried to, we created an organisation to help the other girls as well that have been missing for 20 years and become a very strong support group. But as time goes by, they've all dead, like there was another family, Dan and Beth, they're deceased, Cecily's deceased, and it's only me and Anne Robinson's mother that are alive and still pushing.
Yeah, it's a terrible club to be in, isn't it? But
Yeah, one, you wouldn't wish it up on your worst enemy, really. Mm. Yeah, but when you got responsibilities of looking after the rest of the family, you know, you got to keep going.
Because you still had your son Damien, who was a little
Damien
boy.
Damien was 11. Yeah, he was 11 at the time. Mm. So it was really hard for him as well, and Carol as well. Yeah, so you got to try to support them and deal with their issues and. You know, just being a mum, really. No different to any other mum, but you just got that extra load.
And you became a single mum as well through the process?
Well, Damien was 18 at the time, so he was, you know, he was all an adult, I suppose you could say. You could say.
Yeah.
But you know what boys are like.
Yeah.
He's 35. I don't think he still thinks he's an adult yet.
Julie said, you know, this reinvestigation is going to take quite a bit of time, but we really hope for you that, you know, something new comes up or they find something that was hidden in the files.
Yeah. Well, any sort of answer, you know, you'd be grateful for at this point in time. In the beginning, like Julie was saying, everything was bundled up and no one knew what they were doing, really. They just worked on assumptions.
What do you think the assumptions were that they worked on?
Well, the one thing was that one of us arranged a marriage, and when I went to Charlestown Police Station, I just went off. Because I was that angry, you know, asking them, do I look like someone that I would arrange my own daughter's marriage, you know? And my kids were born and raised here with different values to, you know, to other countries, really.
So you think police even were operating under that idea?
I'd say so. Someone has whispered in their ears. It would have come from our community, I'd say. But, you know, they soon realised that that wasn't the case. But I think with any investigation, the police first look into the family whether anyone has done anything sinister. Where in our case, there wasn't any reasons, you know, you can't find anything that would lead to such a tragic circumstances.
And that wastes valuable time too, doesn't it?
Yes,
when you're looking down,
does,
you know,
yes,
one way, yes, and it's not the way that they need to be looking at.
And plus the detectives and they were from the old school, you know. You got to wait 24 hours. You got to do this. You got to do that. But you haven't got time when something like that happens. Every second counts. So, you know, what do? You can only push as much as you can. And because at the time when she went missing, I was expecting the army to get involved and helicopters. It was my precious child that went missing, but when reality hits, really, there's so many barriers.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. You think the whole world should stop. Everyone should stop what they're doing and search for this child.
Yeah, exactly. And she was a child, like she, you know, just beginning her life.
Yeah, it is hard to believe that people can say things like, no, not yet, we're not ready, we're investigating, madam, we'll get back to you, or whatever, you know?
Wait to see if she comes home
she
after
up.
24 hours. When you know that's not in character for
Yeah, exactly.
For
I Gozana think that's where,
missing.
Yeah, where the influence through the barrister from the legal centre and the solicitor that we had... we had Robert Kavanagh, who was working pro bono for all the girls, and John, I forget his name, Borsick. Yeah, they were working pro bono, and they were involved in this case as well, a young girl that was murdered at Stockton Beach. So I think once we started pushing, and we never stopped as a family, we never stopped. It was every day. It was the same thing. You know, you push and push and push. And they finally, I think after 6 weeks, they got the message that we're not going to give up. Yeah.
Boy, that's a long time to push.
Yes. Yeah. Well, half of my life, really.
That's what it's ended up being,
years.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're not giving up as yet.
Well, how could you?
No, you couldn't. You couldn't for any child.
The Facebook page Gordana's Auntie Julie runs is called Gordana Kotevsky, What Happened to Me? And on it, Julie shares information not only about Gordana's case, but also on behalf of lots of other Australian families seeking help with cases like theirs. You'll find links to it on all of our social media pages. Thank you for subscribing to Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week with a new case and a new episode.